You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. How do we know what's true? One person posts an article on Facebook claiming that the 2020 election was stolen, while another says that making the claim that the 2020 election was stolen should get you kicked off social media and or fired from your job, with both of these claims using as supporting evidence the same security camera footage of ballots being counted in Georgia. Or a video shows up on the internet of a police shooting, and one person says it's a clear case of police aggression without fear of accountability, while another says it's obviously an example of a reasonable response by the authorities in a tense situation. Our examples could go on. How are we supposed to judge between these competing claims when we live in an era of increasingly democratized knowledge? When my argument has the same force as your argument, and both of us value our beliefs primarily because they are ours, how are we supposed to know what's really true about the world? On the show today to help us answer these questions is Jonathan Rausch. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a contributing editor for The Atlantic, the author of numerous books and articles, including the new book we're talking about today, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. Mr. Rausch, welcome to the show.
I am happy to be here. Please call me John.
John.
What should I call you?
Coyle is fine.
All right.
I've mentioned just a few of the things that that you do and have done. Is there anything else you'd like specifically mentioned?
Well, I was a longtime advocate of same-sex marriage. I'm openly gay myself. I'm now married, and unusually, I came at it from the social conservative side of things. So I spent a lot of time working with and talking to socially conservative and religious audiences. And another big interest of mine is religious liberty. I'm a First Amendment nut, and that includes all parts of the First Amendment. And I'm also a gay rights nut, and I think those two things can be harmonized, and I spend a lot of time thinking and talking about that.
Well, why don't we jump into the book that we're working on now? Why don't we start by having you defend your title here? What is the Constitution of Knowledge? I say that as I'm a political scientist. I know what the U.S. Constitution is. I'm a little vague on the British Constitution, but I'm assured it exists. But what is the Constitution of Knowledge?
So my book is subtitled A Defense of Truth. It's not subtitled A Defense of Free Speech, and there's a reason for that. I'm all for free speech. But we have this conception that where truth comes from is this just kind of marketplace of ideas. I say things, you say things, everyone says things, and truth emerges somehow from that process of ideas colliding with each other. And there's some truth in that. I don't want to gainsay that. But here's what we forget. People often say, well, you know, how can you be sure that knowledge, the truth, will emerge from this marketplace of ideas? And they have a point. It doesn't emerge automatically. We need a lot of structures and rules and institutions that incentivize us and guide us so that the process of comparing ideas is a constructive one. And that's what the Constitution of Knowledge is. These are rules that have emerged basically since the Enlightenment period and the Scientific Revolution that channel how we talk to each other, how we debate about ideas, why we don't use ad hominem attacks, for instance, why we don't silence other people if we think we're wrong, but why we do hold each other accountable for our errors, why we require empirical evidence. And then we channel all that through institutions like your university and my think tank and journals and newsrooms and government agencies, statistical agencies and courts of law. That's how we come up with knowledge. So it's an elaborate system. It operates under an unwritten constitution, but like the federal constitution, the purpose is the same, and that's to organize and compel social negotiation between strangers, in this case, all over the world, in a search for knowledge. It's humanity's greatest achievement, and it's also always, including now, one of humanity's most endangered achievements.
Now, when you bring institutions into play, It seems that you're also kind of de facto bringing authority into the question, right? And institutions have leadership and they have rules. So where does authority fit in to this constitution of knowledge? Are there gatekeepers that say, yes, this is knowledge, and no, that isn't knowledge?
It's more like a network. So every society has some way of determining what truth is for public purposes. You know, a lot of people think that Elvis Presley is still alive, so why don't we send him a Social Security check? We have to make decisions like that. Every society does. Historically, the way that's done is some authority is appointed or just seizes power and tells everyone else what to believe. It could be a priest, or it could be a prince. Or if the authority breaks down, you get a creed war. You get a civil war over who's right and wrong, and we've lost countless millions of lives over the centuries. But those were the two standard ways of doing it. Basically, you establish a cult or you have a fight. So some people came along with a radical idea. They were liberals in this small L sense. In the time of John Locke, mid-17th century and afterwards, and said, well, wait a minute. There do have to be these systems and authorities over knowledge, because we can't all know everything. Our perceptions aren't reliable. We come to false conclusions. We listen too much to our friends and not enough to our critics. Well, who's the safe authority? Who's the right authority? They had the revolutionary idea. The authority should be no one in particular. It should be distributed through this huge network of error seekers. And whatever I can do to check a proposition or persuade you of the proposition, you should be able to do the same thing and persuade me. So we need to be interchangeable, like people in a marketplace or like voters, where we all do the same thing and follow the same rules. So, yeah, you get a system of authority with the constitution of knowledge, but it's distributed, it's spread out. We're all able to pose hypotheses. We're all able to test hypotheses. And in principle, we should all be able to do the same thing and validate or invalidate each other's work. So, yeah, it's authority, but it's distributed authority. There's no one gatekeeper. There's no one one way through. It's a network. So if one journal turns down my article, I can try another journal. If you have some new idea, you have the same options. Over time, though, because each node in this network, each person evaluates or institution evaluates the ideas it comes through, it's going to weed out the bad ideas pretty quickly because it won't transmit them.
And I want to keep going on that track, but before we do, since you mentioned the rules of the Constitution of Knowledge, can you give us a couple of examples of those? And obviously, if people want all of them, they can read your book. But can you give us just a couple of samples of sort of the rules by which we've all agreed to play?
Yeah, sure. There are two big ones, and then a lot of small ones that flow from it. But here's the two big ones. No final say and no personal authority. No final say means that, in principle, every proposition might be false and it's open to scrutiny. So you can't end a conversation, which means I'm not entitled to say to Coyle, for example, the issue is settled, you cannot talk about it, and if you do, you're going to jail. That's antithetical to the spirit of knowledge, which says, in principle, you have to keep the conversation open. Well, why doesn't that mean that everything's open all the time and we have to debate whether gravity exists and the Holocaust happened? Because of the second rule, which is no personal authority. In order to establish knowledge, this is the hard part, you have to persuade people that you're right by using means that other people can replicate. So you can't just say, I'm Jonathan, I work at Brookings, and I went to Yale, so I'm right and you're wrong. I have to be able to make a demonstration to you. And you have to pass the same test. And only once we get through those tests, once knowledge has been affirmed by many, many different people applying different tests from different perspectives, does it get established. But once it's established, once it's in the books, once it's on the record, it gets a heavy presumption that it's true until someone can come along and debunk it. And then you get a lot of subsidiary rules that flow from those, like, you know, we don't use ad hominem attacks. We don't bullshit. We take ideas seriously. We don't punish people for being wrong. We punish bad ideas, but not the people who have them. Lots of other things that we try to do.
But what if I'm really good at convincing people that I'm right, and I'm willing to use evidence that can be replicated, but maybe it's not great evidence? And I think we see some of this with things like the Holocaust deniers, right? I say that, I don't know much about Holocaust now. Maybe that wasn't the best example. There are certainly things that I can say, well, here's evidence, it's replicable. Anyone can watch this video. I guess we'll go with the 2020 election, right? Anyone can go and watch this video of people moving around ballots in a room, and that is clearly evidence that the election was stolen or that the election was not stolen. And I'm better at convincing someone than the other side. How do you keep the charlatans out who follow the rules, but maybe they're kind of fudging them a little bit? What's our filter here?
Well, it's a problem, though. I wouldn't say that the problem is mainly charlatans who follow the rules, because the rules are pretty stringent. If you're a prominent person and you come out with something that's wrong and can be disproved, some junior faculty member somewhere, some journalist is going to want to get famous by pointing out your mistakes. So that process works pretty well. Science writ large, this whole system, what I call the reality-based community, makes a lot of mistakes, but its claim to fame, the reason it got us a vaccine, for example, for COVID-19, got one designed basically over a weekend, is it makes its mistakes spectacularly quickly, and it also finds them spectacularly quickly. So it's actually pretty hard for terrible people with terrible arguments to survive that process for long. They can for a while. So the bigger problem and the heart of my book is, what about people who jam the rules, who figure out ways to manipulate and game the system? For example, what if I can get online, say that I believe that the COVID-19 vaccine is injecting a microchip which will control your mind? And there's no good argument for that. But suppose I and a network of other people can get online, and by using a lot of aggressive social media tactics and then a lot of bots and software that's going to amplify our voices, and then installing a lot of endorsements from celebrities and anyone else we can convince, what if I can spoof you and make it look, when you get online, as though there's a lot of scientific basis for what I'm saying and a lot of people are saying it, even though, in fact, we're just a handful of people? We're now manipulating the system. And people have been dictators. All kinds of people have been manipulating our constitution and knowledge for hundreds of years, ever since the beginning. But they've got especially good at it recently in challenging and important ways.
Well, do you want to go ahead and answer your question? What about them?
Well, that's... Okay, so what about them? There's so many different things they're doing and so many ways they're doing it. But my book, a lot of the book, first half basically sets out, so what is the constitution of knowledge? What are these things that we're defending? Why are they important? The critics are right to say, yeah, it's a political system, but it's a better political system than the other political systems. So the first half of the book explains why. Second half is the defense of truth part. It's how you defend the system. So against who? There's two that I focus on specifically right at the moment. One is propaganda, disinformation, online spoofing, and other tactics that are designed to fake a consensus or drown out true arguments by simply making random false arguments, a tactic called the fire hose of falsehood. Donald mm-hmm. Trump was extremely good at that tactic. Using other forms of disinformation, turbocharged by software, social media, and other methods, to basically cause mass disorientation, polarization, confusion, cynicism. Again, these are old tactics. They go back to Lenin. The Russians were always brilliant at them, but now they've been turbocharged. The second big threat I talk about is what people often call canceling. I call it coercive conformity. But this is another way to spoof people into thinking that they're isolated and a minority, misunderstanding where the consensus is. And that's by using social pressure of various types to intimidate and silence people of a particular point of view. And by doing that, an actually fairly small group of activists can make themselves appear to be a large group of people and maybe even speak for a consensus and can make other people afraid to speak out. I think the big, I would argue, the sort of big new idea in my book is that these things look very different. Disinformation, for example, and, Russian propaganda on the one hand and cancel culture on the other. But they're actually deeply related because they're both ways of manipulating and dominating the information space for political gain. And they're both ways of undercutting the constitution of knowledge.
I think we should probably talk a little bit more about this. So you talk about groups who break off from the constitution of knowledge and functionally form cults, right? Isolated from the rest of society, and I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think where we run into a problem is we have the situation now, where for all intents and purposes, 40% of Americans have formed by that definition a cult. A cult that thinks, you know, we spend too much on welfare, foreign aid, and politicians' salaries, and if only we'd built the wall, the fake pandemic wouldn't have happened. But then we also have that other 40% of Americans that thinks we need to combine a radical personal autonomy with aggressive social planning. And each 40% thinks that the other is destructive and needs to be marginalized, if not eliminated. And each is utterly certain of itself. I mean, at some point, have we gone beyond cults into competing constitutions of knowledge? And if so, what do we do with that?
Well, so there's only one reality-based community. That's its great claim to fame. It's designed according to the rules that we talked about earlier. It's designed so anyone can talk to anyone, and they can compare the same reality, and they may disagree about their findings. In fact, they usually will disagree, but they'll be able to have a conversation about a common reality. And that breaks down when you get a situation that I call epistemic secession. And cultism is one variety of that. And this happens all the time in society. There's nothing abnormal. There's not even necessarily anything wrong about it. But that's when a group of people just say, you know, we don't want to be part of that constitution of knowledge for whatever reason. We want to do something else. We want to take our ideas from, say, Q, this anonymous figure who seems to be posting online, and we're going to let that be the judge of our reality. So people have always done that, and up to a point, that's fine. People believe all kinds of things in their private and personal lives, and they go to church. They believe in God, which isn't a scientific concept, but it's real and valid and important in managing our lives. The problem becomes, as you mentioned, Coyle, if people become so divided that their realities no longer intersect enough to do business with each other politically. And that's where we're headed in America right now. We're in a country where a majority of Republicans at last check believe something that is simply not the case, which is that that Donald Trump was the real winner of the 2020 election and it was stolen from him by a conspiracy. That's simply not true. But you've now got a critical mass of people who believe it. That makes talking about democracy and running elections a lot harder. You've now also got media establishments, which are fracturing, particularly on the right. You've got a media ecosystem, which is less interested in disconfirming, which is the role of traditional media when it's doing its job. You know, it goes out and checks, and if it's wrong, it drops the story or refutes the story. But this new brand of media is more interested in making money by confirming people's biases. And that's also a different form of behavior. So that's kind of spinning off in a separate place. So that's the problem we face right now. And it's a serious problem. People call it an epistemic crisis. And that's not a bad word.
Well, and again, I think that your constitution of knowledge is such a good way to talk about it, because it's at the point where there are so many people who believe that it is a constitution, right? And then what do you do when the constitution itself has become corrupted? How do we resolve that?
Another little tiny question.
Right? And it's not just the right. So, again, I'm willing to say both sides are guilty of this in their own ways, which you are very fair in the book. I do want to point that out too.
Well, okay. So how do you defend the constitution of knowledge? A lot to say about that. Do you want a long answer, medium answer, or a couple headlines?
Give us maybe a headline and then a medium long answer. Just start and go. And if we start to go too long, I'll let you know.
Okay. The short version is there's no one or two things that you do. The short version is we've seen disruptions like this again and again as new technology have come along ever since the time of the printing press. And every time we have had to readjust a lot of institutions and a lot of social norms to cope with those things. And in the past, we have coped successfully. This one's very challenging in its own way. But it's going to be a lot of changes in lots of institutions in society, everything from journalism, which is my field, which has got to become better at and is becoming better at understanding disinformation and not falling prey to it. Academia, which has to become better at diversifying. It's getting so monotonal in so many in many disciplines and departments that you're not seeing enough diversity of view to actually check for error. Academia is losing credibility. It's coming to be seen as a kind of left-wing politicized industry. That's very bad for the constitution of knowledge. You need to help citizens become more media literate, more literate about facts, and that's beginning to happen in Europe, not so much here. Turns out critical thinking training, though, is a helpful thing to do. You need some redesign in social media. Again, we're waking up. Social media is a big problem. It's undermining its own business model with a kind of epistemic race to the bottom, but it is working on that issue. It is trying to figure out better ways to structure its policies and especially its program designs so that it can be less hostile to truth and less friendly to disinformation. You're going to see changes in the way we track all this stuff. We now have observatories and academic centers around the world which are now tracking disinformation. You've got citizen posses which are embedding themselves inside the disinformation networks and alerting outsiders to what's going on so you can catch this stuff earlier. You need all of that, and you need better public awareness. Now, I'm not confident, but I'm cautiously optimistic because we're doing so much better on this front than we were doing even 4 or 5 years ago. If you think about the disinformation campaigns in the 2016 election, which were successful to the point where the Russians were able to trigger competing rallies on opposite sides of the streets, completely bogus. The groups that were supposedly fomenting the activism didn't even exist. This was all being run out of a building in Leningrad. We've gone from that and the widespread laundering of fake news to much more cautious media and much more successful resistance to disinformation in 2020. So I'm sorry about the long answer. This is a problem with this book. It's hard to summarize, but it's a lot of things at a lot of levels of society getting a lot smarter and making our institutions smarter. And the good news is that's starting to happen. The bad news is it's always a race between the disruptors and the reestablishers.
Well, I appreciate your cautious optimism. I suspect you have different social media contacts than I do.
Cautious would be the word to underline. There's no cause for complacency. The people doing this stuff, the disrupting, the canceling, the disinformation, they're super smart. And they've got some amazing new technologies on their side, technologies we've never had to deal with. And that makes this, in some ways, a uniquely tough problem.
Yeah, and obviously we're starting to get a little far afield of your book. But it is interesting in that even that brings up the problem of the disruptors for the disruptors, I guess, for lack of a better way to put that, are coming from their own epistemological perspective, right? So they're making the assumption that they are right and the other side is wrong, which you're not supposed to do in the constitution of knowledge, right? You're supposed to test and you're supposed to explore and you're supposed to experiment and question and prove. But we're also at the point where we don't agree. We've lost that consensus.
Here's the trick to this. So the U.S. Constitution, this is a core concept of the book, and I think you're a political theorist, so yeah. So you'll be all about this. So the core of the U.S. Constitution is it does not assume agreement. It assumes pluralism. The greatest insight, I think, of politics in all time is James Madison. What do you do about ambition? How do you contain it? You pit the ambitious against other ambitions. You use it to contain itself, and you do that by forcing persuasion and compromise. That doesn't mean people have to give up their principles and not have strong views. It just means they have to go through a process of winning elections, of then developing legislation, of building coalitions, of persuading other people so no one faction can dominate. And this whole process, as James Madison says, depends on pluralism. It depends on having a big enough republic so that there's plenty of opposing views. The trick is to channel those opposing views into a peaceful politics by requiring compromise. So that's our political constitution. The epistemic constitution starts out with John Locke, who's also a founder of the liberal political tradition. It does the same thing. It says, look, we don't need to agree on anything. We don't need to agree on facts. We just need to agree on a public social process that we will abide by in order to get to facts. And sometimes we will win, sometimes we will lose arguments, but we will do our best to persuade each other, believing deeply what we believe. Science relies on us to believe deeply in order to defend our views strongly. But at the end of the day, if we're proved wrong, we understand society will move on and we won't have persuaded any. We'll have lost the argument. We won't have lost our lives. That's a huge social innovation, but we'll have lost the argument. So here, too, you've got a system that depends on pluralism and diversity and channeling that diversity into a process, structured process that gives you knowledge. So, no, we don't have to agree with each other. We don't have to have the same ideas. In fact, the system would completely fail if we did that because then we'd be living in a cultic echo chamber. We'd just be confirming each other, making huge mistakes and never realizing it. So the thing we're defending here is pluralism of viewpoint and sincerity of argument. And those are the things that the cancelers and the disruptors are trying to attack.
And it seems that there's kind of a two-pronged issue where on the one hand, there are the people who are unwilling to lose, right? The people who say, we're going to use the rules and the system that we've all agreed to play by to smash the other side. And that's, in a sense, that's both sides, right? Both the trolls and the cancelers are promising that support us and you're going to and we'll win and the other side will lose. And the other side will lose because they hate America or they hate minorities or whatever, they deserve to lose. But then the other side of that problem, so that would seem to be one issue, is that willingness to be defeated has gone by the wayside. But then there's also the practical reality of when we're talking policy, one side's going to win and one side's going to lose. Like the law is going to be passed and it's going to support your team or my team. And we have fundamental disagreements, right? Fundamental epistemological disagreements over what that should be in the first place, which then just increasingly drives us into that first camp, right? Is that making sense? We seems like we're in the point in our society where we're using the constitution of knowledge not as a place to argue and discuss and come to some kind of consensus, but as a weapon to beat the other side with.
That is happening a lot, and here's a reason I think it's happening, and it's because of a fundamental misconception that I think you mentioned along the way, and it's that these are zero-sum arguments in politics or in knowledge. If I win, you lose. If I'm right, you must be wrong. Over and done. Well, the foundation of the U.S. Constitution, Madison's other, I think, fantastic stroke of genius, is he understands compromise is not splitting babies in two and thus having two dead halves of a baby. Compromise is a dynamic process that actually introduces new and better ideas than either of us started out with. We have to say, well, what I want won't work. What you want won't work. Maybe we'll try option C. Maybe we'll combine the two. Maybe we'll reach out to some other idea. Compromise actually improves political outcomes over so that both sides can win. Maybe not always in the short term, you know, if you're arguing about a pot of money. But in the long term, that's been the great dynamic source of American progress, is forcing ourselves through this dynamic compromise process. Well, the same is true in the epistemic world. If we obey the rules of the Constitution of Knowledge, if we submit our views to this process of checking by anyone, anywhere, we don't always have to agree that we've lost the argument. In fact, we'll often disagree. We'll say, well, I was still right, but no one accepts that I'm right. But in the process of contending, pitting ideas against each other, someone else is going to come in the side and say, well, you're both wrong, or let's combine these two arguments, or you're not even arguing with each other, or they'll say, here's some new evidence. It's going to resolve it, or it's going to take it to the next level. Same thing. We get the progress of knowledge because these controversies, this persuasive cycle, doesn't mean that one of us loses and the other one wins and we triumph forever. It means that we all gain. Actually, both of us will wind up better informed in the end. So this breaks down when you get the mindset that, Coyle, you just alluded to, which is people forget the importance of persuasion and compromise, how dynamic it is, how much we need it. And they start thinking in terms of win, lose, victory, defeat, all or nothing. They start thinking scorched earth. They start getting polarized. They start thinking, you know, if I lose this argument, if I lose this election, it's all over. People like me will be wiped off the map. Then they get scared and they begin to abandon these rules. And then you wind up in the kind of political and epistemic problems that we're now seeing.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, they're the problems we're now seeing. So it's how do we de-escalate? Right? How do we step back? And that's your sort of last chapter, which I do want to get to. But before stepping that direction, we've talked about you draw the parallel between the American Constitution, Madison's theory of the Constitution, Federalist 10 and 51, and all of that, which is great. I mean, that's like you said, I'm a political theorist. That's kind of my bread and butter. I find economics incredibly dull, but if you want to talk about the economic Constitution, I want to make sure you have the chance to do that because it is also an important parallel. You do bring in Adam Smith and sort of the free market as a point of contact here too.
I do mention it. I don't really go that route because a lot of what I'm trying to do with my book is I love the marketplace of ideas metaphor.
Yeah.
But it's a transactional metaphor and it implies some kind of marketplace where ideas are just traded back and forth. And I'm trying to get people off of that because I think that the model we need to think much more about is Madison's model, a political model of using pluralism, harnessing pluralism to force compromise. Cause that's where the work really gets done. So, there's three great liberal social systems, and they've revolutionized humans as a species. They've taken us from small groups of tribes constantly in war and then empires constantly at war to the kind of globe-spanning species we have now. And there are three of them. One is political democracy. Another is economic markets. And the third is liberal science, broadly defined, the constitution of knowledge. The first one concerns itself with political power. The second one concerns itself with allocation of resources. And the third concerns itself with how we get knowledge. And they're all based on the same principles, which is forcing ourselves to deal with strangers, a huge network of strangers on impersonal rules. And that's a very hard system to run. It takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. Of course, economists have spent a lot of work and a lot of effort trying to understand how the economic system is articulated. And same with the political system. So what I'm doing in this book is saying, well, let's look at the science system. Let's look at the knowledge system, figure out how that one works, and then how to defend it.
How does the constitution of knowledge, how does it handle either intangibles or questions that can only be answered in the future? So climate change, for example, right? Is global warming happening, and is it being caused by humans? In a sense, we're not going to have an absolute answer, right? And until either it happens or it doesn't. And you've got kind of both sides, one side saying we need to take action now or it's going to be too late. And the other side saying, well, if we take that action, the economic social devastation is going to be greater, even if it's true, than whatever the results of climate change are. And neither side can know the reality-based system that you talk about. It's not going to be reality until an indefinite point in the future, whoever is right. So how does the constitution of knowledge navigate those kinds of sort of intangible futuristic questions? We could say the same thing about morality, right? How do we know what the ethically right thing to do is? Well, until we've done something, it's all kind of academic and that can't be sorted out. What do we do here with our Lockean system?
So this system is what it's really about is organizing the search for knowledge, organizing arguments, hypotheses and the people and institutions who have them on a global scale. And no, it can't resolve everything firmly and crisply right away. And it's often going to have arguments not only about the issues, but arguments about the arguments. It's going to say, is this even a valid question at this point about global warming? Hasn't it been settled? And then you have arguments about arguments about arguments. Well, that seems crazy. How would you ever get to the bottom of anything? The thing is, this system turns out to be surprisingly good at achieving consensus or progress toward consensus on a lot of issues, including moral issues. I'd argue as a gay person, I owe my freedom, my liberty in this country to the ability that I had and that other activists have had since the Supreme Court decision in 1958 that allowed us to make our moral case and our political case that was intangible, but without the ability to speak and make arguments and show that other people's arguments were faulty, including their moral arguments, which are often hypocritical, we would not be where we are. So this system isn't perfect, but it is amazingly good at picking up error and doing that pretty darn quickly. And it is unquestionably better than the alternative, which is someone coming along and dictating to everyone else what they have to believe.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting point here about the relationship between transcendent claims from a religious perspective or a philosophical perspective and their role in this constitution of knowledge. And as I was reading your book, I kept going back to this. I have kind of the two sides of my brain, and the one side is the Burkean conservative side. That certainly inclines naturally towards your book. Yeah, 100%. This is how culture works. This is how cultural knowledge works. This is the way society works. And then the sort of Christian side of my brain that says, yeah, yes, but there's also a specific place for that. And as a believer, I have this revealed truth it's not that I don't question it, right? There is a theological method for that. But it's not subject to the marketplace of ideas, rightly understood, in the same way that global warming is. And I appreciate that your book is useful for kind of inspiring thought in that direction, if that's a good way to put it.
But I'm so glad, Coyle, that you brought that up, and it's especially meaningful to me to talk to someone at a religious university about this, because of course, you guys have the dual task of teaching critical thinking on Lockean grounds, the constitution of knowledge, these norms of rigorous checking and testing, yet you're also transmitting ancient religious faith and traditions and a kind of deeper, different kind of knowledge. And a point I try to make in my book is true of both the U.S. Constitution and the constitution of knowledge. One of the other great things about Madison's Constitution that requires so much appreciation and praise is what that constitution is doing is not only setting out the powers of the government, but limiting the powers of the government. And it's saying, well, you don't have to run your family according to the U.S. Constitution. You don't have to run your church according to the U.S. Constitution. In fact, you're expressly allowed to have separate rules for separate institutions. We're only structuring this public conversation about government policymaking, law, and politics. So by creating that barrier, it allows a free society to exist on the outside. Well, the same is true of the Constitution of Knowledge. It says we have exclusive domain in what's taught as knowledge in textbooks. So you can't be a biologist. I'm guessing even at your school, I'm not sure, but you can't be a biologist and teach that the world was created in 6 days, 6,853 years ago. Even if you think it's true. But the Constitution of Knowledge is also limited in the same way. It says all we're talking about here is what counts as knowledge from the point of view of society and public policy. We have no jurisdiction over what you teach your children about God or religion or morality. We have no jurisdiction about what goes on in your church. It makes that separation and allows people the freedom to have these dual lives that make life so rich, where my example is Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, one of the great scientists of our time, also a devout Christian. How can he do both those things? Well, the answer is that's the beauty of the constitutional knowledge. You can have these two worlds, these two epistemic worlds, one for the public stuff that you've got to do and one for the private stuff that supports your inner life and your family life and your community life.
And obviously one of the, and this is, again, separate from the topic of your book, but one of the ongoing public discussions we're having is where does that boundary fall, right, between public life and private life? And that's where First Amendment stuff comes in, right? Freedom of religion stuff becomes relevant there.
This is all, actually, it's not outside my book. It's all super relevant. But the boundary questions are always hard because I'm going to say this is a private belief and you're going to say, no, it's influencing me. Because if your kid doesn't get vaccinated, my kid gets exposed. So we're always going to be arguing about the boundaries. But the key concept of liberalism, whether it's on the epistemic side or the political side, is it says there are boundaries to argue about. We're not just going to mix and mash everything together and say the government gets to decide everything or the priesthood gets to decide everything or there won't be any government at all. So we have to argue about the boundaries, but we accept that there are these boundaries. There are these limits.
Let's jump into your last chapter here on responding to the current situation, and specifically you offer some tools for people who are either engaging with the disruptors or who are responding to cancel culture. What do we do practically? How do we strengthen and support the constitution of knowledge in such a way that betters society, reaffirms reality and truth, and responds to these sicknesses in our society?
Well, I already mentioned a bunch of things across a broad front that need to be done to protect our knowledge-making institution and our knowledge-seeking selves from disinformation and propaganda, so I won't repeat those. On the canceling front, which we haven't talked quite as much about, that's where you try to manipulate the information environment by socially intimidating people. So you create a false idea of that, you know, that only a few people believe what a lot of people believe, and a lot of people believe what only a few people believe. So that's also going to require a multi-layered response. One is that it needs counter-mobilization. We've seen one side be very aggressive in organizing, for example, to organize a social media mob to punish someone who is seen as an ideological threat. Well, we need to counter-mobilize so there are defenses for people who are hit by that, so they don't get fired right away. Counter-mobilizing will allow some evening up of the odds, and that's begun to happen. I recently wrote about a whole bunch of new groups that are arising to mobilize on the liberal side of things. You also need to make sure and strengthen diversity. Too many academic departments and too many newsrooms just don't have enough conservatives around anymore to have a full debate and see their own blind spots. Human beings are ineffably, by our DNA, we don't see our own biases, and we have them. Boy, do we have them. We rely on people with other points of view to point them out to us, and that's not fun. But if we don't have that exchange, knowledge ceases to exist, and we're just talking to ourselves. So I argue that it's academia needs to start taking, of course, it should take demographic diversity seriously, but it needs to take viewpoint diversity seriously. There's now widely documented discrimination in academia against conservatives on many levels because conservatives are so outnumbered. So we need to start focusing on reducing those kinds of obstacles and discrimination so we have more viewpoint diversity. Same thing, though, to a lesser extent, in mainstream media newsrooms. And then there's what do we do as individuals? And there I have a lot to say. One of the things I have to say, though, that's really most important is don't shut up. Remember, what disinformation, trolling, and canceling, and social intimidation are really all about is trying to demoralize you. So you feel like it's futile for you to speak up and say anything, either because there's so much confusion out there and so much hostility and trolling on the internet that you just want to be done with it. You don't know who to believe. You're disoriented into silence. Or because you're afraid you're going to get so beaten up on social media or in your workplace or maybe investigated or maybe fired if you say something disapproved that you're going to just keep yourself silent. The result of that's what sociologists call spirals of silence, where I stay silent because you stay silent because I stay silent. So we need to speak up. We need more support for people who speak up with diverse viewpoints, and we need to be willing to do that ourselves. We need to not allow ourselves to be intimidated. We need to remember, big lesson in my book, you're being manipulated right now by people who are trying to use information techniques, disinformation techniques, to isolate you, intimidate you, deplatform you, or demoralize you. Don't let them do it. You need to be wise to what they're doing. You need to speak out and talk back.
Can't we just care less about social media and have the same result?
Well, not if it gets you fired.
Well, yeah, that's fair, I suppose.
This is the real world now, unfortunately. Social media is not limited to social media anymore. And it's not just a social media problem. Canceling is not a new problem. It's described to a beautiful perfection in Alexis de Tocqueville's famous Democracy in America. 1840, he comes to America and sees widespread canceling and says people in America, just if they sense that they're on the wrong side of a moral consensus, they just shut down, they go away, they don't dare to speak out, and this becomes self-reinforcing. That's why he talked about tyranny of the majority. You don't need social media to use social pressure on people and workplace pressure, economic pressure, to shut down an argument. There are all kinds of ways to do it. Social media is just the newest, fastest, and most efficient. And the solution is always the same, which is understand that these tactics are being used and push back.
Yeah, and I think that your point about the accelerant of the internet and social media particularly, right, is a good one. It's not new, but things don't just dissipate because they hang around for, because they've been around for so long anymore, right? It's now all, once something happens, it's all instant.
It's all out there. It's all instant. It can be anywhere, anytime. You know, you, not you personally, but an academic, for instance, has always had to worry about, well, if I say things that are deemed too unacceptable on my campus, on my university, will I lose teaching assignments? Will I get bad evaluations? So maybe I should just keep my head down about my conservative views. That's not new within your campus. But what is new now is that someone from an entirely different campus across the country, or maybe even in another country, can see a lecture that you've written or an article that you've written, within minutes start a social media campaign and have a petition going to get you fired, which will then cause an outcry on your campus. And you wake up tomorrow morning, your entire life is different. That's new.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not even the case. So certainly when I was starting out, there were times when I was, you know, in my early 20s and perhaps not the most thoughtful to begin with. If I said something that I thought had offended a student, I could, and I think did a few times, just pull them aside and apologize, and that was kind of the end of it. But now that's not because of the internet, because of the connectedness. That's no longer really an option. Or it's an option, but it doesn't solve the problem. Should be done. It should be done, but it's not the solution anymore. So, yeah. Well, let me again encourage our listeners to go out and pick up this book. It's fantastic. We focus mostly on sort of the right side of things because I'm a conservative and kind of naturally biased and gravitate that direction. But it is very even-handed. You do a great job of kind of breaking down both sides, walking through the issues with knowledge, and give just a great rigorous defense of the Constitution of Knowledge. Thank you again for writing this book. This was great. Anything you want to end with?
Well, apart from thanking you for a great discussion and the opportunity to talk about some of these, you know, parallels are pretty subtle between the political constitution and the epistemic constitution. So it's hard to talk about in a way that's quick and engaging. I really appreciate the chance to get into it in depth with you. But I also like to I like to add something that I say whenever I talk about free speech, which is often, which is, if you feel like it's an uphill battle defending against canceling, trolling, or more traditional enemies like old-fashioned government censorship, which is very much alive and well in many other countries, if you feel discouraged about that, just remember that the single most strange and counterintuitive social idea of all time is the idea that opinions and arguments which are blasphemous, heretical, offensive, obnoxious, wrongheaded, socially destructive, The idea that views like that should be not only allowed but protected is the single strangest and most counterintuitive social idea of all time, bar none, redeemed only by the fact that it's also the single most successful social idea of all time, bar none. It's made free societies and all the knowledge and freedom and peace that we take for granted possible. But because it's such a weird counterintuitive idea, you and I and your kids and their grandkids will have to get up every morning for the rest of our lives and explain it all over from scratch. And we just need to be cheerful about that. And we can be cheerful about it because we're actually doing incredibly well when you think how well we've done at preserving these freedoms and the system that makes knowledge. So hang in there.
Well, that's a great place to go out on. So thank you again for taking time to do this. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning into the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.